The global economy into somewhat depressing stops. Also, and on a lighter note, a little bit of Game of Thrones today. Spoiler alert from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 20th of June. Great to have you here, as always, everybody. You know how, when we're doing certain stories, there are stock phrases that we use to set them up? Like, if we're talking about congressional legislation, you always hear, and it's headed to the president's desk for his signature. Or with a Supreme Court case, you always hear, a decision in the case is expected by summer. Or with a big merger deal, you hear, subject to regulatory approval. We will start today with one of those regulatory stories. If you work for a big company, there is a decent chance that you get your health insurance through an Anthem or a Cigna network. I mention that because Anthem has offered $48 billion to buy Cigna. It would be the biggest insurance company in the country. But there is word now that regulators might not be in that aforementioned approving mood. From Washington, Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
Any big merger like this brings out powerful business groups, ostensibly speaking for consumers. Anthem swallowing Cigna would cover 54 million patients, whom the company say would get more choices of providers competing for their medical dollars. Attorney Alan Grunis advises Cigna.
You'll have doctors and hospitals competing to be in those networks. That competition can be beneficial to the employers and to their employees.
Now, hospital and doctor lobby say a tie-up, which would eliminate a Big Five insurance company, would limit choice in many markets. Yes, they speak for patients, too. But there are signs the Justice Department agrees. Recently, a top antitrust official said customers do not benefit from mergers simply for bargaining clout. He said the feds have a long history of challenging insurance mergers. Why? Robert Towne teaches healthcare management at the Wharton School at Penn.
You don't know that until after the merger's already happened, whether they will be able to actually negotiate those better terms. In mergers, it's probably more common that these efficiencies are not realized than they are actually realized.
Wall Street isn't sure about the deal either. Analyst Anand Gupte at Leerink Partners says the chances of it happening have fallen from 75% to 25%.
I've heard from various pretty reliable sources and experts that multi-state employers are not supportive of the merger.
Cigna stock is now 45% below the value of the deal, suggesting investors are skeptical too. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
All right, here's kind of an amazing statistic global economy-wise. China, says a new report from the consulting firm McKinsey, spends more on economic infrastructure every single year than North America and Western Europe spend combined. You look at the low cost of money for the U.S. government, just for one, cheap, really cheap, with interest rates so low, and one can legitimately wonder, what is going on here? Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the answer.
Washington, D.C. calls its dilapidated subway situation Metropocalypse. New York City may have to shut down an entire line between Brooklyn and Manhattan for a year.
It's going to be really horrible. And it's going to be so jam-packed every day, it's going to be crazy.
New Yorker Greg Farrell there. But nationally, problems with subway infrastructure, really not the half of it.
There are a lot of really high-return infrastructure projects that the U.S. is not building right now.
Tyler Duvall is a partner at McKinsey. It did a recent analysis of U.S. infrastructure spending.
Large-scale bridge reconstruction projects, transportation, water, wastewater.
Duvall estimates the U.S. needs to spend about $125 billion more per year just to keep things from getting worse.
To see significant improvements in that, you'd obviously need to go even higher.
Infrastructure investment and maintenance create jobs, it's widely argued. At a minimum, they make people's lives easier. John Gibson, professor of economics at Georgia State, argues they reduce inequality.
Investing more in infrastructure can increase wages to poor segments of society.
So why is there such little political will for infrastructure spending? Partly it's because paying for infrastructure and getting credit for it can be kind of complicated between local, state, and federal money. And then there's the issue of instant gratification, or lack thereof, for political leaders. Douglas Holtz Aiken is president of the American Action Forum, a center-right think tank.
You're probably not going to see the benefits for years, maybe more years than you're going to be in office.
No one wants to think about the long term until they're late to work because of the subway shutting down. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Speaking of long term, short term on Wall Street today, Brexit? What Brexit? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Our correspondent Scott Tong was down in Venezuela a couple of months ago, and he brought back stories of what it's like to live in a lopsided economy. An economy where oil is basically the only thing an entire country has going for it. Well, there is new news out of Caracas and the rest of that economy as well about how much worse it's gotten just since this past spring. Looting, food riots, shortages of virtually everything. Girish Gupta is the Reuters correspondent in Caracas. Girish, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
When you go out and walk the streets of Caracas today, what does it look like? What's the scene?
It's a very tense situation in Caracas right now and all across Venezuela. What do I see? I see supermarket queues. I see lines of people in their hundreds or their thousands just standing outside supermarkets here in the sun. And it's pretty horrific to see. And it's not just at, you know, at the poorest parts of town. It's all over the city and all over the country. And what really surprised me here, and I've been here for 5 years reporting on Venezuela, covered protests and so on, I've never seen the levels of hunger that I've seen in the last couple of weeks. I saw a food riot the other day, just in Caracas itself, actually, and people were telling me they hadn't eaten for a day or two. There was one woman in her 50s who said she had an egg the previous morning. It was now the afternoon of the following day. It's pretty extreme stuff, and that sadly wasn't abnormal. People are desperately hungry. They don't care about politics. They don't care about economics. They want food, and that's dangerous for the government here.
Is it just low oil prices combined with years and years of economic mismanagement? I mean, is it that simple?
Yes, ultimately it is. It's quite extreme. The price and currency controls here essentially mean that importers can't get goods in because they can't get hard currency. No one's producing in this country anymore, and it's just come to a head now because oil prices have fallen so much. And it's also that the big issue is that Venezuela obtains around 94-95% of its foreign income from oil. That's right. A huge percentage. So as soon as the prices drop, they cannot feed these currency controls. They cannot give money to importers. And sadly, people are hungry.
What's the government done, the government of President Nicolas Maduro?
The government of Nicolas Maduro, who is not popular right now, they are really struggling, and he's nothing like his predecessor, Hugo Chavez. I mean, these policies did come in under Hugo Chavez's tenure, but of course he had the benefit of high oil prices, and he also had the benefit of charisma. Maduro doesn't really have either, so it's been very difficult for him. They are implementing new strategies, new policies, but it's essentially the same thing we've seen before, and they're not working.
The black market probably functions. If you have cash, you can get goods, yeah?
Ish. The black market is the idea of, you know, if people can get these price controlled goods, which they really do struggle to do now, then they can pay 5, 10, 100 times what they're worth at that price controlled rate. I'm earning foreign currency. I'm earning a standard wage in the US or UK. And there's a lot of stuff I can't get. It's not because it's too expensive. It's because you cannot get it here. So if I can't get it with my wage, which is far more than, say, $15, $20 a month on the black market rate, which a lot of local people are earning, then what chance do they have?
Right. Those folks, the people who can't get the goods no matter the price, the people standing in line by the hundreds and thousands, what do they say when you ask them where this goes from here? What do they think is going to happen?
No one's thinking long term, not the government nor the people on the streets. This needs a short term solution. If you hadn't eaten breakfast, the previous day, you're not thinking about economic policy or where this goes or whether you're going to support a recall referendum launched by an opposition that doesn't have much support in itself. You're thinking about where to get food. And I hate to say it, but it really is very different from the protests we saw back in 2014. This is genuine desire for change and necessity for change.
Girish Gupta, we got him down in Caracas. He is the Reuters correspondent there. Girish, thank you very much.
Thank you.
British pound rose against the dollar today. Foreign exchange traders seem to put great stock in a new poll about the Brexit vote over in the UK this coming Thursday, a poll that had those who want to remain in the European Union ahead. It's a big deal, this vote, and for the record, it's the second time in as many years that any kind of exit from the European Union has been contemplated. Last summer, it was Greece teetering on the brink of departure from the EU, a Grexit, as it was called. So we sent Marketplace's Stephen Beard down to Athens to see how the Greeks feel about the Brexit.
The shops and the cafes of Athens are full of tourists. The Greeks should be feeling more confident. The country is about to get more bailout money, and Grexit is off the agenda. But now, says Efrosini Pavlakoudi, a telecom engineer, there's another dark cloud on the horizon.
Well, if Brexit happens, I would be terrified. There would be so much the turbulence in the markets and in the whole European system. I think Greece would suffer more than anyone.
More than Britain?
More, definitely.
The Greek economy, she says, is still mired in recession and acutely vulnerable. But she reassures herself the Brits will surely not vote for Brexit after so many have warned them of the dangers.
Even their unions announced them what would be the risks. The Bank of England announced them what would be the risks. And they are rational people, British people. They know what they're doing.
At his travel company in Athens, Philip Brinkman also can hardly believe that the Brits would vote to leave. He's puzzled. Why should Brexit have so many supporters in the UK? The country's capital, London, is the ultimate urban melting pot.
I don't think there's any other city, not New York, not Paris, not Brussels. I don't think there's any other city which has actually shown that it can be truly international. It's interesting that it's especially Britain who has probably the most international city now wants to leave the project called European Union.
But it's precisely the influx of so many European migrants into London and the rest of Britain that has turned many Brits against the Union. The EU is certainly not popular here in Greece either, for different reasons.
Εντάξει με την παραγγελία. Ετοιμάσαμε τα λουλούδια.
Many Greeks, like the owner of this flower shop in central Athens, Spiros Kontogiannis, feel bitter about the EU forcing Greece to submit to deep budget cuts and painful reforms.
They want people to work like slaves, feeling that they are alone, that they are threatened, that they have no future.
You think then the Brits might be better off out?
Yes, I think for the British people it's better.
Many Athenians blame the EU for Greece's 51% youth unemployment. Psychologist Elena Christidi says the union is sick. She prescribes some shock therapy.
I think I'm pro.
Pro-Brexit?
Brexit, yes. Because I think there must be some changes in the European Union so we can rethink Europe. We need a totally changed union.
A revolution.
A kind of revolution, yes.
That's not a remedy which Kostas Papadopoulos favours. He's the boss of a large publishing house, Dioptra. He fears that Brexit could lead to the unravelling of the whole union, with bad results for Greece.
By the skin of our teeth, we stayed in. If England goes away, we could be out ourselves. And at the moment, if we're out ourselves, I don't think we will survive, to be honest.
But he does not blame the Brits for holding a referendum.
I really appreciate mature procedures, and I think this is a mature procedure. No matter if this can come very much against me and my country, I think it's a mature procedure.
It's democratic.
Democratic, yes.
If the Brits do vote for Brexit this week and they get it, Brexit backers will hail it a triumph for democracy. But as the Greeks know only too well, there could be profound economic repercussions. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, when was the last time you shopped for a handbag?
All right, well, technically never, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 129 points today, 0.7%, 17,804. The NASDAQ up 36 points, 0.7% there as well, 4837. The S&P 500 climbed 12 points, 0.5%. Also, 0.5%, you could say, 2,083. We told you earlier about that pending merger between Anthem and Cigna. They mainly offer commercial health plans. Anthem up today, 0.25%. Cigna down about 1.2%. There's a whole bunch of smaller health insurers out there. Molina Healthcare, founded by an ER doc in Long Beach, operates Medicaid health clinics in California and five other states. Molina shares up nearly 2% today. The coal industry is flat on its back, but there are glimmers of higher demand, like my house today, 105 degrees. More air conditioning, please. Rhino Resource Partners, up 23%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. First of all, spoiler alerts ahead about last night's Game of Thrones, so you've been warned. Second of all, Jon Snow is an idiot. Am I right? Didn't Sansa warn him? Yes, she did. Of course, there's a whole lot of Game of Thrones fans out there who didn't get to see the Battle of the Bastards on HBO's megaseries last night because HBO's streaming service HBO Now crashed during the show. Not the first time it's happened. So 15,000 customer complaints later and counting, there is really only one question. Haven't streaming companies figured out the whole streaming thing yet? Marketplace's Jed Kim is on that one.
Okay, don't worry. No more spoilers. Thanks, Kai. So it's unclear where things went wrong. HBO refused to give an interview for this story, and Major League Baseball didn't respond. Wait, baseball?
Major League Baseball had been developing this internet video infrastructure for over a decade that was considered outstanding.
Mark Taer wrote Televisionaries, a book about the switch to digital television. He says after past streaming failures, HBO turned to MLB Advanced Media when it launched HBO Now. MLB is great with live events, but
even if you're with the gold standard for internet streaming video infrastructure, you can still have a significant problem.
One problem, says Sam Rosen at ABR Research, the internet wasn't built to distribute episodes the way TV and cable companies were.
Instead of having hundreds of copies, one per network, you have, you know, millions of copies, one per subscriber.
And there are many places along the chain where things can go wrong. But he says the technology is improving, and even the occasional crash won't hurt HBO.
I don't think it breaks the emotional connection with the piece of content. I think it increases it and makes people more aware of it.
That scenario actually plays out in another HBO hit series, Silicon Valley. The company's live stream gets so many views, it literally sets servers on fire.
If you hit those servers, you kill our live stream, Jared.
Right. HBO could have another kind of fire to put out if it doesn't get things right by Sunday. That's the season finale. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
The promise of the digital age, all right, one of the promises, has been that information will be available to us wherever and whenever we need it or want it. And to a large degree, that is true. One area, though, that is underperforming on that idea is in healthcare. Federal healthcare IT people say it is now just a bit easier for hospitals and doctors to share patient data than it used to be. And here's the thing. Information might want to be free, but sharing it is not. About two-thirds of the software vendors who develop electronic medical records now post their prices online so that providers can know how much it's going to cost to transfer records from one hospital to the next, because healthcare is a business. From the Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Dr. Alan Kumar's on duty when a man in his 60s comes to the ER at Community Hospital in Northwest Indiana. Kumar says things were so bad, Community was the third hospital the man had been to that day.
He felt that he wasn't getting answers and presented here as a last hope that what's going on, can someone please help me?
The whole family is uptight, nervous.
They know something's wrong. They're not sure what it is.
Based on the symptoms, Kumar worries about a serious infection or cancer.
My initial plan was to do a full battery of lab tests, do an x-ray, do a CT scan of the abdomen. That process would typically be about 4 to 6 hours.
And how much money?
Oh, you're talking thousands of dollars.
Instead, Kumar opens the medical record, which includes the other hospital's workups, and is back with the patient and his family in minutes. This is how things are supposed to work. Competing hospitals sharing health records for the patient's good. When the government invested $30 billion to get hospitals and docs these electronic health records, this was the dream. And now, more than 96% of hospitals are digitized, nearly 80% of physician practices. The infrastructure to deliver on the promise of information sharing is there.
Now the challenge is to connect and wire together all of the systems that have been adopted. That work is a little lumpy.
Arian Malik is an executive with the software vendor McKesson. One reason work is lumpy is that you've got hundreds of vendors with systems that often don't talk to each other. Imagine if an iPhone couldn't call an Android. So vendors have banded together.
Technology is the easy part.
That's former health IT official Jody Daniel, now an attorney at Crowell & Mooring.
The really challenging part is the business issues, the operational issues, and the trust issues with exchanging information.
Never easy when you've got natural competitors trying to collaborate. A much bigger hurdle is that vendors make money by charging hospitals and docs to share patient data.
We are struggling and beating our heads against the wall every day.
Farzad Mosashari is the former health IT czar at HHS. Now, he works with independent physician practices. He tells a story about a New York doc who wanted to make sure his electronic health system could talk with another.
And the vendor is saying, oh, okay, that'll cost you $50,000. Does it cost the vendor $50,000 to build a standard interface? No, it doesn't cost them $50,000. It's their opportunity to make a buck.
Simply sharing patient data, which, as we saw in Indiana, can improve care and lower costs, runs counter to the financial incentives for the software vendors. Mosashari says it's time for a national conversation.
The question is, in healthcare, are we okay with people saying there's some life-saving information, but if you don't pay, you don't get it?
Washington's paying attention. Federal health officials have pushed Congress for more oversight to ensure health records are built to share data out of the box. As the nation pushes closer to the kind of information sharing they've got in Indiana, it's forcing us all to grapple with the reality that there's a fortune to be made from this data and to ask whether anyone should stand to profit from it. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
A moment now to consider the next handbag purchase that you or somebody you know is going to make. And now, another moment to consider. And actually, maybe a couple of months to consider. There is some new research out that says some women are waiting longer between deciding to buy a new handbag and actually making that purchase. It's a consumer behavior story that Elizabeth Holmes, the senior style reporter at the Wall Street Journal, wrote up. Hey, Elizabeth.
Hi, Kai.
Months and months and up to a year's worth of research to buy a purse. Is that right?
Well, when was the last time you shopped for a handbag?
Which is a fair comeback, but I mean, come on.
It's a very personal purchase. I have to say this story was a little bit selfishly motivated because I have been looking for a handbag for a while now. And I saw this data that came out that said women are becoming these very deliberate handbag shoppers. And so women are not only researching on e-commerce sites, but they're doing things like reading reviews of the bag and then watching YouTube videos to see how much a bag holds. And it's not like this is some chore that they're feeling like, oh my gosh, I have to research my handbag now. It's very fun for them. They find it to be kind of a source of entertainment. And so it's this like long journey to buying a handbag.
Okay, you mentioned retailers and how it makes for a more satisfied customer. Point granted, but the sales are being delayed by the months and months and months it takes for these shoppers to make up their minds.
Yes. So this fits into sort of a broader trend that we're seeing among some shoppers, which is a departure from, you know, the fast fashion world and into buying fewer but nicer things. And so the win for retailers here is that people are willing to spend a little bit more when they shop less often. And especially a handbag is seen as a real investment piece. A lot of women carry the same bag every single day. So if you think of the ROI on that, it's pretty good. And so you're willing to spend a little bit more. But they take longer to buy it. And so they're shopping less often.
Are we talking like $3,000, you know, I don't even know if Kate Spade costs that much, but that was the name I came
it
up
does
with
not.
At the time. Okay. Well, what was a really expensive one from like 5 or 6 years ago, the crazy expensive one?
Chanel, you know, right. A Chanel or, so, you know, a Birkin is sort of
right, Birkin. Top. That's not what we're talking about for most shoppers, right?
No, I think that's, you know, just like any luxury shopper, that's sort of the upper tier there.
Right.
I think there are a lot of mass shoppers, though, that are very attracted to handbags that are in this $250 to $500 or even $1,000 range because it's something you can save for, but it's attainable. It's not, you know, you don't have to blow several months rent on it. But, you know, you could save up, you know, one woman I talked to was, you know, going to put $10 or $20 aside every week and then get a $600 bag. And then she thought perhaps she's going to like it more for having put in all this work.
Yeah. And it becomes a little project, right?
It does. And it's something to think about. And it's fun. I can't underscore that enough, that these shoppers really feel like they're doing something that's entertaining to them.
Mm-hmm.
And then
at
the end, the payoff is they have a new handbag. It's pretty great.
All right. So brass tacks here. Did you buy yourself a purse?
I have not yet.
Oh, come
which
on.
Is the worst,
no.
Right?
You got through this whole article and you didn't do it?
I'm actually carrying like this embarrassing canvas tote at this moment because I can't decide. But I have been researching for a while, and I do.
Is it fun for you still? Is it fun? Or
we're now
is it
reaching
now
the point of diminishing returns.
There you go.
My husband would like me to just decide already.
Elizabeth Holmes, she writes on fashion for the Wall Street Journal. Elizabeth, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Good luck with the handbag
thing. Thank you.
Final note on the way out today, in which I discover why my lattes sometimes feel a little bit light. A federal judge in San Francisco has given the green light to a fraud and false advertising lawsuit against Starbucks, in which two customers say the company systematically underfills its beverages, often by as much as 25%. The foam on Starbucks lattes, plaintiffs say, displaces actual milk, and thus consumers are denied their proper portions of tall, grande, and venti drinks. I gotta say, I've got some sympathy here. All right, we're a little tight. I'm going to try to get this all in. The Dow of 129 points today, 0.7%. The NASDAQ added 36 points, also 0.7%. The S&P 500 climbed 12.5%, or as I said before, about 0.5%. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Robert Garoba, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. Come on, you got to try, right?
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.